today's featured guest, Dr. Chris Martinson from Peak Prosperity. Dr. Chris Martinson, economic researcher and futurist specializing in energy and resource depletion, co-founder of peakprosperity.com. Welcome back.
Thank you.
I know that you are something of a crude oil market aficionado, and we saw an explosive move just over a week ago of over 12% in a single week. It came ahead of the announcement that OPEC, or the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, would have a surprise agreement to cut crude oil production. There's been lots of speculation over the last 8 years, but they really haven't come together and agreed on anything. And they seem to have gotten even some of their non-colleagues on board. Tell us what this means. What are the implications here?
Well, we've been waiting for something like this for a long time, but I kind of believe that OPEC is a little bit like the Fed. That is, they move once it's already obvious that they have to move. The Fed's going to raise rates here because they have to, because interest rates have already moved and they don't want to look like they're behind. OPEC has been talking and talking and talking and done nothing, and now that the world is pretty close to a supply-demand balance for oil. This is not something I think most people talk about, but I'm convinced that the world is pretty close to balanced at this stage, and now they're talking about maybe dialing back a little bit. Look, Russia agreed to say that it was going to cut, air quotes here, cut 300,000 barrels, but the truth of the matter is their fields were going to age out and they were going to lose that production anyway. Saudi Arabia again said they were going to cut, but first they rammed their available production up as high as they possibly could so that it'll fall back to what I think is a slightly more sustainable number for them. And yeah, even some non-OPEC countries have decided to get in on the fray. I've been saying for a long time, oil's got to go higher. It has to. Even at 55, it's not balanced. People listening to the U.S. media, you would think that shale companies could drill all day long at 55 and be perfectly happy. The answer is not true. Most of the plays do not turn out any profits until you get to 60, 65, 70, even higher, depending on where in the play we're talking about. So I've been expecting oil to go higher. It's going to go higher, and it has to because the world's consuming more of it. United States hit a record of gasoline consumption. China hit a record of imports recently. So consumption's continuing, and supplies are just about balanced. So, yeah, this move in oil does not surprise me.
You know, the technicals are very strong here as well. But what I keep hearing from guests and folks who write in is that, look, Chris, there is a massive glut of oil in the United States, perhaps greater reserves than we have ever seen. I mean, there's tankers just waiting offshore to unload. Why are you so bullish on the sector? How do you address this?
There's a little bit of opacity, the cloudiness in this market. And part of it is, you know, you have to understand what the United States actually has in store. So people often say oil as if it's a single thing. That'd be like saying, oh, we've got a lot of food, right? Well, kind of matters if you have oats or corn or wheat or, you know, pork. It kind of matters a little bit. So the United States has been cranking out a whole lot of something called condensate. And it's a very light mixture of oily residue. I mean, it's lighter than gasoline. And we have a lot of it. In fact, we have too much. We have quite a bit in storage. And that's the stuff when you hear about the United States is now an oil exporting nation. Back up. We still import 7 million barrels a day, but we have this other stuff we need to get rid of. So that would be a good question for your listeners to sort of ponder is, well, if the United States has so much in storage, why are we still importing so much? It just doesn't make sense. Well, it does once you understand that what we're importing is the stuff that can go straight into our refineries, and what we're piled up with and what we're exporting is stuff that we have more of it than we know what to do with. So there's a little bit of complexity in this story, and that's how I think it makes sense at this point in time. And yes, you know, gasoline and oil stocks are at pretty high levels here in the United States. But to be clear, even if we said we have 450 million barrels of oil, sounds like a lot, but we're burning about 18 million barrels a day.
But I'd also like to know what you think about OPEC. I mean, most of the estimates are in the neighborhood of a reduction of approximately 1.2 million barrels a day by January of 2017. Do you really think that the policymakers will stick to their guns, or does that even matter? I mean, is this just a general consensus, and it'll over time have a big impact on the market?
Listen, the oil market is a really inelastic market. All you need is just a little bit of supply shortage, and prices will move pretty vigorously in response. Here's the wild card and why I think OPEC has to be really delicate here. If OPEC suddenly pulled 3 million barrels off tonight and oil shot up to $100 plus per barrel, now we'd see a lot of explosion in energy stock prices, but let's remember 2008. One of the reasons that we had that crisis when we did was because oil went to $147 a barrel, and that absolutely was a pin that pricked the bubble economies of all kinds of weaker countries, particularly the so-called PIGs, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, Spain. Those countries they import all of their oil needs. They have no domestic oil supply, and so when oil got expensive, it hurt their economies. At this particular moment in time, if oil suddenly shot up to $100 a barrel, I believe we would see a very large economic impact. I think we would possibly see a very strong recession, and that would then serve to kill oil demand. So OPEC has to really be careful about both, you know, the amount of oil they're supplying and the price at which it's being supplied, and they can't afford for the prices to move too rapidly to the upside. That's how I'm seeing it.
All right. In recent weeks, our listeners were, I think, surprised to hear that Indian President Modi removed two of their most widely circulated bills from, you know, the economy, insisting, well, the economy must go completely digital. And all transactions taxed, about 89% of their economy is paper-based, unlike 30% here in North America. And on Monday, Venezuelans rushed to deposit their banknotes or dump the cash altogether following Maduro's announcement that he would remove the 100 Bolivar note. Now, what's interesting is we've dropped to just 2 cents on a 100 Bolivar note. Right now, inflation is approaching 500% over just the last 48 months. They're closing national borders, particularly with Colombia, to keep the flow of currency and other assets out of the country. Do you see the tie-in here between India and Venezuela? And do you think that we might see a systemic global situation where currencies devalue and policymakers take similar steps?
Well, I got to be honest. You know, India's move still doesn't make sense to me. I still don't understand it. Let's look at just India for a second. We'll get to Venezuela if we have time. So India had currency in circulation, and they are a very cash-based economy. 80% of their economy runs by cash, right? Particularly in the poor and rural areas, it's like almost 100% of that. There's like 50% of their people don't even have access to a banking system, right? They don't have bank accounts. So the whole idea, well, let's just move electronic. Helpful if and only if you have a debit card or other electronic ways of participating. Most of India doesn't. So real confusing. And here's the statistic that really caught me. Right before Modi's move, there were about 18 trillion rupees in circulation. Immediately after the move, it dropped it down to 10 trillion. So we went from a value of 18 to 10. This is a massive decline in the currency available in circulation. And when you have an economy that's largely run, I mean, it's 80% run through cash, I don't know how this doesn't just absolutely clobber the economy itself. So I think India in the next few months, we're going to see some awful GDP data. It's really confusing to me why India would do this.
The cover story, the most predominant at this point, seems to be, oh, well, there was a huge counterfeiting issue with the two notes. Apparently, they claim there was tremendous amount of smuggling of these counterfeit notes into their country, and thus we're going to remove them. And, you know, we did something kind of similar here in the United States. For the longest time, you would see $500 notes as well as $1,000, and those are virtually non-existent today. The argument at the time was, well, we need to curtail counterfeiting because, of course, that's more bang for the buck for the counterfeiter. I think that's what really has a lot of conspiracy nuts, if you will, or theorists, you know, banging the table that what really might have been happening here. Of course, we had the wedding festivals coming and other festivities where gold is purchased in large sums. The Indian gold imports surged in the past month, as you might expect. But now there's an attack on that. The general guess here, guesstimate, is that they may have been trying to stop gold inflows to support the rupee. But I was just curious to see if you thought that other nations might be thinking of something along the same lines.
Well, in the case of Venezuela, quickly, the amounts I heard that they would have recalled because they've devalued so badly is like $6 million worth or something. I mean, it sounds bad because they're removing a prominent note from circulation, but the notes have no value anymore. It's not clear to me why they would spend even the effort trying to retract notes that have a circulating value of about 2 U.S. cents. They certainly need to introduce, you know, a brand new bolivar, the 20,000, and soon to be followed by the 200,000, and on and on. They're caught in the grips of a major, massive inflationary problem in Venezuela. Very different from India's problems. You know, their economy was growing well. It's not a conspiracy theory to say that the explanations India's given us don't make any sense.
What's happening in Venezuela, I think, is clear. I think he wants to stop the bags of currency coming into the counters and whatnot, A, because it doesn't make a good soundbite, B, because it winds up on YouTube. You know, it makes his regime look bad, and it's inefficient for that matter, but somewhere in the neighborhood of 20,000 Bolivar notes will be circulating now. Look out for 100,000, and then Zimbabwe. This argument they're making, this socialist concept behind why this, they're claiming that there's a political foes are behind this. They're trying to destroy the economy. But in the final analysis, I mean, it's inflation. I mean, you've let the genie out of the bottle. I want to know when this might happen in the United States. Do you care to speculate?
Well, it'll happen at some point. You know, there's a really great chart that came out about a month ago, and it was put out by Bridgewater Associates. That's Ray Diallo's giant hedge fund. And it showed the combined liabilities plus debts of the United States. So that's, you know, Social Security, entitlement programs, Medicaid, Medicare, plus all the debts. And when you add them all up, it comes to 1,100% debts and liabilities to GDP. 1,100%. Meaning, you know, to pay it all back, we would need 11 times our GDP to pay for that. So listen, full stop, we can't honor all of those agreements. So the way that hyperinflation or inflation comes to the United States is if you can imagine a scenario where we have politicians who, instead of saying honestly, hey, everybody, so sorry, we're just going to have to not pay what we said we were going to, or they say, gosh, maybe we could convince our friends at the Fed to just print up a bunch and then we could pay people, which, you know, that's, to me, the far more likely outcome. Look, it's just so much easier to print and pay rather than to face up and have to be the person who reads the Austerity Act to your own people. So, you know, it's always possible we get leaders who go down the austerity path, but very unlikely, historically speaking. So there's no strict, you know, if people were all being perfectly rational, we'd already be in hyperinflation because people would look at the liabilities of the United States and say, y'all can't pay that, and you don't have the backbone to deal with it, so I don't want to hold dollars. But that's not how the game gets played. Everybody plays musical chairs and dances until the music clearly stops.
Exactly. And, you know, I think an even more compelling component to this story is the Fed's balance sheet, which I know you've looked at in very closely. But it's interesting to note that the balance sheet has been essentially static around $4.5 trillion now for approaching, I want to say, a year and a half, 2 years. Maybe they're just waiting for the next crisis, downdraft in the economy. Do you have any input as to whether or not we will see that Fed balance sheet double and then double and double again, as we did see following 2008?
I do believe so, and here's why. You know, the Federal Reserve 25 years ago was a different beast, and their job was to solely manage money supply and making sure the markets were well supplied. But they didn't concern themselves with how many people were employed, or, you know, whether more businesses were borrowing, or any of these, you know, these economic drivers. And then they got really interventionist under Greenspan, and then Bernanke, now Yellen, and they all believe, like, they've gotten themselves into a point now where the Fed is responsible for markets. And so the first thing that's going to happen, though, is that all this printing will eventually be proving to everyone that just because you drive financial assets up, you haven't really done anything for the underlying economy. That's a big old air pocket. That starts to hit. We're going to call it deflation. It's going to scare people. We're going to see yields spiking and equities falling at the same time. There's going to be nowhere to hide. and then there'll be this hue and cry from everybody, save us, save us. And the Fed will be asked to step into that deflationary maw and save us. And they'll do that by printing.
I think it's ironic because you're essentially outlining what's likely to occur tomorrow or this week at the FOMC, you know, meeting. I mean, obviously, our policymakers will raise rates at least a quarter, certainly a quarter point, 75 basis points. And then we're likely by June, July of next year, according to the Fed funds futures, we will almost certainly see another quarter point. Still, it's a big regime change, if you will, over the last, let's say, decade, where rates have been so low for so long. It just changes the dynamic of what we should see on a forward basis in the economy. Do you care to speculate if and when higher rates might impact the economy? I mean, look, we've got the stock market recently, week after week, at all-time record highs for the Dow Jones Industrials. And at the same time, real estate and new home starts continue to surprise on the upside. Unemployment around 4.6% national unemployment rate and been in a downward trend for, you know, since 2009. These, at least on paper, look awfully solid. They don't seem terribly deflationary. Give us an idea of how this might backfire.
Well, the first way it's going to backfire is that the Fed has already created a condition where there's very, very different interest rate differentials across the globe. So look, my view is that you know, the U.S. economy or financial system can't be analyzed in isolation. You couldn't do that for 20 years. You know, now you have to understand that the global capital is this giant pool of money. It doesn't know borders, and it's just looking for relative advantage. So can it sell the yen and buy the dollar or vice versa, or is it going to be in Kiwi bonds? Who knows, right? It's just flowing all over the place. So here's the first thing to know. When the Fed, it raises interest rates again, it's going to create conditions for a lot of money to start leaving Europe and start coming into the United States. Same thing for Japan. So I think the first thing we're going to see, paradoxically, you know, we're going to see more of a rise in the U.S. dollar, and we're going to see more strength possibly in U.S. financial assets, because all that money flooding in is big money. It's got to go somewhere. It's just the nature of the game. It doesn't mean it should or it makes sense, but this is what's going to happen. And as that liquidity pulls away from Europe, the pressures will build again. Europe's in really tough shape. You know, the Italian banking system's completely upside down. Please pay attention to what's happening in Portugal. Greece, just as bad as it ever. So all of these pressures are still there. I think it gets worse, though, when this flood of money that's looking for relative advantage starts pulling away, retreating from Europe and coming into the U.S. And that's where, you know, I think the European Central Bank and the Fed are a little out of step at this point. And so those sorts of things create those pressures. But even though we're going to see that first flood of money towards the United States, if that creates enough difficulty, as I think it will, then we're going to have to find ways to reverse that. So either Europe has to raise rates, which I don't think they'll do, or the U.S. has to find a reason to cut rates, or something has to happen. So this is, if I could give just one phrase, this is the age of imbalances. 2008, warning shot across the bow, lots we should have done, could have done, didn't do in order to address the real reasons for that crisis. And so here we are with imbalances that are as startling as anything we've seen ever.
No, exactly. I mean, it really amounted to that nearly 100 million people of working and able-bodied, you know, adults here in the United States who are looking for work are either disgruntled, have given up. You have a unique perspective on many areas. I know it might seem off our purview here. Artificial intelligence, automation, robotics within the employment situation in, let's just say, North America. For instance, I'm sure you saw or maybe read about Amazon recently opening a fully automated retail shop, which is interesting because here we have the world's largest online retail and remarkable success online, now making a push into the brick and mortar, you might call it, avenue, as well as claiming they're going to the grocery business. Latest estimates have dropped dramatically. We were looking at maybe 10 to 15 years before this might actually impact the everyday employee. Do you see a potential threat, or will this just be another industrial revolution where we all learn how to program machine language?
There's pros and cons, there are pluses and minuses to this whole story. You've outlined a number of them very well. The first is that this whole idea of using machines in the place of humans is an idea that cannot be put back in the bottle, because it's extraordinarily capital favorable. And it's particularly capital favorable in a country like the United States, where we have, if you hire a human being, you know, a wet, moist robot, what do you get? Well, you have Americans with Disability Acts, you've got OSHA, you've got workplace discrimination laws, you've just got this huge amount of things you have to worry about that don't come with a robot. So, the hourly cost that you have to pay somebody is often half what your fully burdened cost of carrying that human is. And so that's going to start. Two, it makes sense to automate a lot of things. If you've ever been stuck in a traffic jam, you know, for hours on end, you realize that, well, if everybody was driving in an autonomous car, these things wouldn't exist anymore, because it would be reasonable coordination. And that's true, that same, you know, thing is true of all kinds of supply chain management, and I'm a huge fan. Let's use stuff more effectively. Let's use it more efficiently. Let's not waste if we don't have to. So that's all on the good side. The downside, we have to go back to what Henry Ford said when, you know, why did he pay his workers $5 a day? It's because he wanted them to be able to afford his products. If you take the robot story to its logical conclusion, capital wins, labor loses, and we don't have a plan for how we're going to deal with that yet. Let me make it simple. Let's imagine one guy, it's you, you own one robot that can do everything in the world. Nobody else has to work. There's clearly that would not work out very well, because nobody would be able to buy anything from you because they're not working. It really raises some very large, very thorny issues, and we've seen some early openings to that, which is this whole idea of living wages and basic income and stuff like that, which is in part a reflection of the idea that we've gotten ourselves to a point where we don't need very many people working to run our economies anymore.
Obviously, the universal basic income is on the table now. But the other issue I think that we have to wrap our minds around is the exponential nature. And I know you're aware of Moore's Law. We've hit a bit of a brick wall there, a ceiling, if you will, with the constraints of silicon in recent years. I mean, anybody who loves to stay on the cutting edge of a desktop, if you will, or laptop computers knows we've been just stuck for 5 or 6 years in an abyss here. They're having a tough time getting past it. They will eventually. The exponential nature of artificial intelligence and robotics, this machine learning concept where, let's say, an infant, if you have a child or you know a child, or you've been a child, you know that it takes weeks, years to learn a language, to become proficient, to become an expert pianist, or to learn, you know, advanced calculus and mathematics. These things require an excessive amount of proficiency that just takes years of practice. These computer expert systems, they can learn at a phenomenal pace because they run through scenarios instead of at a human pace at maybe 100-fold. And so they're learning at such an exponential pace. I think when you include, and maybe we're going too far out of the box here, but you include the artificial intelligence along with the robotics, it seems like we're moving towards at a much faster pace than we anticipated. It used to be maybe 2050, then they dropped it down to 2035. Now folks are saying that we're looking at about 2025 when human level intelligence or higher becomes affordable to every individual. Do you care to discuss the implications of that on not just the economy, but maybe society as a whole?
Gosh, it's such a huge trend, and it's going to have just extraordinary impacts. I've been a big believer that virtual reality is going to have an enormous impact, because what it'll effectively do is allow our human selves to interact with and interface with, through technology, things that we otherwise would have to travel vast distances to wrap our minds around. And similarly, you know, I'm working with some people who have their fingers right on some of the biggest of the big data, meaning that they're able to begin to track in real time actually what's happening this is scary, but they track people's cell phones so intimately they can tell you which stores are getting more foot traffic, and that this is a precursor to maybe, you know, that's what you can tell that this store is going to be doing better than another one, and so on. And these were things that were unthinkable just 10 years ago, as you mentioned. So we're watching this develop at such an extraordinary clip that there's cause for concern and there's cause for jubilation, and at least in part, I think we're getting, you know, here's where I find hopefulness in this story. We're getting to the point where it's kind of beyond humans to really understand and manage this very, very large thing that we call this Earth that we're on. And we really do need access to some really calculated, beautiful, sort of, you know, big data sort of interpretations of what's happening. I think that if we had better visibility into what's really happening in the world, that we would see that, we have to behave differently here, that the ecosystems are going to require us to back off and not put so much pressure on them, whether that's the tuna stocks or aquifers or soil or anything like that, as well as the energy situation. There's so much we need to do to be able to revamp that. The way I'm a little bit, I got to be honest, not as hopeful is that for whatever reason, data doesn't really change how humans behave. So having more of it, I'm not sure is going to help. Open question, but listen, we already know how to build buildings that require zero energy inputs over the course of their life, and we build almost none of them at this point in time. And not because we don't have the ability or because we don't have the data that says we really should be doing this, because we should. We don't do it because we don't think it's necessary yet. So this is where it all gets a little squirrely for me, because humans, we like to think of ourselves as rational, but we're not. We're really emotional creatures, and we make decisions based off of our brainstem, not our cortex. So I think it's fantastic that we're getting these, you know, artificial intelligences coming along, and I'm worried that humans are still operating as humans, and we won't know how to manage or even deal with the results that these things might spit out at us, because we won't recognize them. Like, well,
you know, I wish I had more time to keep up with the cutting edge science fiction. You know, if you want to continue stepping outside the box and maybe even jump out the window where the box is located, some of the more, I think, cutting edge concepts that are making the rounds now include the idea, I'm sure you've read, of course, the holographic universe. This has actually gained a lot of traction within the cosmological circles, as well as within particularly the quantum physicists. There's this idea with AI, the idea of the simulation world, where either our ancestors or a godlike being, or maybe in quotes God, whatever your idea, your concept there, in the distant future has created a simulation-like world where we are living now. And this is, I know, seems a bit far-fetched, but what's interesting is the error-correcting code at the subatomic level, near the string level. A couple of the offshoots of this concept would imply that if and when we cross this threshold of a singularity with AI, it might, I know this is going to sound bizarre to a lot of our listeners. It does to me as I say it. But the computational resources required to continue simulation, i.e. our universe within this multiverse, would become too computationally inefficient, or let's say expensive, and the whole system gets shut down. That is starting to gain some traction, because everyone looks around, we look around the universe and we say, there's other intelligence out there. Why haven't they contacted us? Why can't we see them? Why haven't we found their residual communications over the, 13 or so billion years with our universe? And that, well, the reason why we haven't is that there is might be a dictate throughout the universe that we have to keep that noise quiet, because we haven't reached a level yet to where we're able to accept this. So I know I've thrown a lot of information out there on the table. Is there any of these abstract concepts you'd like to discuss?
When we study what, say, the old Buddhist or Hindu or Sufi masters were saying about the nature of the universe, and they say, you know, that all life is energy and all this stuff, and we're like, oh, that's crazy talk, until scientists come along and say, oh, no, that's actually how we understand all this stuff. And now we understand through the experimentation with the quantum states that particles and energy and matter exist in a very, very different sort of a way at the quantum level. And people say, well, that's okay, I live at the Newtonian level, so I don't have to worry about that. But it's not that there's two ways, the Newtonian and the quantum. They blend and they blur and they all run together. So here's how I connect to that. You know, when reading through the memoirs of Einstein, Carl Jung, the psychologist, and Herbie Hancock, the jazz musician, they all had some articulation of this sentence, which is, I didn't do any of this. It just came to me through the silence, right? And so puzzling that you would find all three of these highly creative people saying that they weren't responsible for their genius, that it came to them through some other method. And then we cast back and we notice that the Mayans somehow managed to calculate with utter precision the 40,000-year processional of the spiral arm of our galaxy. Like, think about 40. Any one human being squinting at the sky long enough has only, you know, 80 years to do that. You can't possibly calculate that, but they did. So what's emerging to me in this line of thinking is that humans have access to something that's far greater than we appreciate or understand at this point, that there's an intelligence, if we could call it that, that exists, that we have access to. And my data for that, I gave you a few examples, but I'm going through history and I see example after example after example where people had access to intelligence that was way beyond what their culture should have been able to allow them to step into. But
one of the interesting aspects of that, many of the folks you just discussed, as you, I'm sure you know, Srinivasa Ramanujan also agreed with everything you said, that it was the goddess Namagiri. It's ironic. In the last 48 hours, I've just been studying Buddhism and Hinduism, mostly from the perspective of vegetarianism. I mean, over 2 years now, a strict vegetarian. I agree with you. I think that obviously, just as Kurt Gödel of Incompleteness Theorem, as I'm sure you know, was just absolutely brilliant, pointed out that no matter what system you have, there's always an external influence. And that really, I think, in many ways, he proved the existence of a creator. From a logician's perspective, the concept that there must be a God, because no matter what mathematical system you have in place, and axiomatically, at least from that perspective, there's always another external influence that comes into play. So incompleteness is possibly the nature of our reality. What I was kind of wanting to lead up to is this idea of AI, because, you know, we see Terminator and Predator and all these in the mainline movie industry and whatnot, and we read all these ideas of how it could be so destructive. What I find more interesting and compelling is how it might be incredibly not malevolent, but benevolent to society. If you had a godlike intelligence that was perhaps found its own way to communicate with the spiritual world, because keep in mind, we're dealing with an incredibly intelligent being that might be evolving 400 times a day to a higher level. I mean, this is something so exponential that I don't think humans have the ability to even extrapolate the outcomes from this.
This is a fascinating line of thinking. I dabble around here, just like, I don't know how you could do anything but dabble in these sorts of realms. But, you know, what's occurred, so here's what's obvious to me as a scientist who studied, came up through the biological sciences, is, you know, once you really look at evolution itself, like where, you know, life started as single-celled things, but now you look at it today, and it's clear that evolution has an impulse to it. It's got a direction it's going in. Why? We don't know. You know, Darwin sort of said, oh, it's just because, you know, survival of the fittest, but that can't be it. There's more to the explanation. There has to be more to the explanation than that. And so where I sort of start to blend these things together is I'm really a believer that we are consciousness itself having a human experience and becoming conscious of itself. That's my thread of spirituality, and I believe that most major religions express that at heart somewhere, that God is within all of us, whatever we're calling God. I don't want to offend or promote anybody's particular deities here, but this idea that something greater than ourselves exists out there, and we're just a part of that, not apart from it, but we're a part of it, is kind of how I experience it. And so it says to me, you know, that this is why in this particular moment of time, where you look across the news and you see all the predicaments and it looks kind of hopeless and all of this and all of that, that's really a wake-up call to step into what I think we're really here to do as humans, which is to have a full experience of being alive, right? So, you know, all of this is starting to coalesce for me, and the deeper I go into really studying where the world is going, the more I realize that this is an extraordinary time to be alive and that this is calling each of us to greatness. And that part of getting to your greatness is not a question of going out and accumulating anything new. It's not going out and you have to go to school to become great. You don't have to finally get that job or that, you know, career to become great. It's instead a process of removing the things that we accumulated that are in the way of us expressing what's automatically within us. And each of us is great in different ways. It's not saying we're all the same, right? I don't believe in that. All people are created equal. I think that everybody has equal access to gifts, but those gifts are different. So it depends who we're talking about and all of that. So yours could be different from mine, not higher, not lower, not better, not none of that. But you've got gifts, I've got gifts, and the only way humans get through this next period of time, I believe, is if we strip away the junk and we get down to what's real, and each person really starts bringing their full, authentic selves to the game. That's what I believe in. I think we all have access to that greatness. But again, it's a question of getting to the stillness within us. It's not a question of having to acquire anything new.
The path that you've outlined here is remarkably similar to that of course, Buddha, which at least according to history or legend, was a wealthy individual who had all the experiences of life and protection, never even witnessed even a single atrocity until he left, you know, this great palace in which he lived, and then went into a life of asceticism, if you will, and along the way accepted virtually everything you've outlined here, that all these objects and this materialism that we find ourselves thrust into this system is actually a series of blockages from the correct path that you want to be on in order to reach the ultimate goal that this life was intended to accomplish here on Earth. And I think you've done it just a great job laying that out there. And I hope that folks outside of that type of tradition, which will be most of our listeners probably today, can maybe try to embrace it a bit, because it's not just one culture or one religion. I mean, you know, Einstein became a vegetarian very late in life. He said the greatest way to end violence in the world was simply to encourage a non-meat eating culture. This is a remarkable statement from an absolutely remarkable individual. It's not just him. Almost every one of my heroes, Nikola Tesla, I think he was 50 to 100 years ahead of his time. There's some indication that Leonardo da Vinci, who I believe all in all, maybe even eclipsed Archimedes as the greatest mind. Now, there's some argument there. May have been the greatest intelligence that we know of, at least today, in the Western world. In our culture, we don't think about the lesser beings. But if you listen to Buddha and you read the Vedic texts, it says, no, wait a minute. We are brothers and sisters with all living beings, even plants to a lesser, far lesser degree. So we actually improve our existence when we look out for these things that we view as cannon fodder, practically, in this culture. So, you know, any parting comments or perhaps some comments on the precious metal sector? Maybe you have some, hopefully, a ray of sunshine for 2017 for our listeners here.
First, you know, people, of course, can find me at peakprosperity.com, and we've got a vibrant community there, and would welcome any of your listeners to come and join the conversations we're having. Of course, we're discussing precious metals as well. And my view at this point is that it's almost like a battle between good and evil. And I know that the authorities are hell-bent on continuing their programs of financial repression. And that simply means corralling everybody, giving them no escape routes, and then forcing whatever policies, including negative real and nominal interest rates on them, if necessary. You know, the beatings will continue until morale improves. And gold, of course, represents an escape valve. It's a big threat to the Western interest on that basis. They've had a very long and obvious interest in depressing the price. You know, we've recently heard that silver was, you know, of course, as we understood, heavily manipulated, and there's a data for that now. So another conspiracy theory becomes fact. So, and by the way, if all those companies out there, HSBC, et cetera, and Deutsche Bank, were busy slamming silver to the upside, I guarantee you that would not have been allowed to continue for as long as it had. So the system's interested in keeping us out of context, and they would like us herded into their little pens of misery, which would be if everybody only has electronic money and all of that's contained in the system, all we have to do is turn a knob and everybody loses a little bit and we win. That's really the direction we've been heading for a long time. We'll see if they get there. Gold and silver still represent to me the number one way for an average person very easily to take some of their money out of that system with the idea that, A, you don't believe in the system, and you don't want to support it. Also, B, that they may well fail in their wild fantasies of creating a big financial prison for us all to live in.
Firstly, totally on board with you regarding this, the noose that just continues to tighten around us collectively. I mean, obviously, you need some type of protection. And I worry even a little bit about the blockchain concept promoted as, you know, a potential digital gold, if you will, or digital savior, because there's some indications that this has some connection with our, let's say, security agencies. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if they try to completely outlaw it or put some really strict constraints on Bitcoin and related. And keep in mind, I'm a huge fan of cryptocurrencies. Actually created my own humble little silver-backed cryptocurrency using the Ethereum blockchain. But nevertheless, I think that that could just be putting people off of the right path that we've been talking about here, and that is solidifying or crystallizing their wealth to protect it for all of the reasons that you've laid out so well here today. All right, well, thanks for being patient and running with some of these abstract ideas, and we'll look forward to talking again in 2017.
Thank you. Look forward to it.
The gold and silver mining sector is red hot. Every investment portfolio needs precious metal shares. GoldSeek.com's top stock analysts have done it again, identifying the next solid gold nugget opportunity, Brazil Resources. Based in the eighth largest economy with a mining-friendly reputation, almost 10 million ounces of gold reserves, industry insiders are accumulating shares of Brazil Resources. The notable management team includes Chairman Amir Adnani, a rising star in the mining industry with a reputation for moving projects rapidly into production. Fortune magazine lists Chairman Adnani in the prestigious list of 40 under 40 ones to watch. Plus, shareholders benefit from the insights and backing of enigmatic Brazilian billionaire Mario Garneiro, CEO of Brazil Invest Group, the nation's foremost merchant and investment bank, and founding director. Their São Jorge project is 100% owned with paved highway access, a nearby workforce, and a hydroelectric power source near the major gold deposits. Their next top project includes three deposits identified by major gold producers, plus their Ria project, which is a joint venture with Areva, benefits from a $10 million treasure map in the hottest address for uranium production in Canada. But the story gets even more exciting with their Whistler project, offering geographic diversification in South Central Alaska. To find out more about this unique opportunity, please direct your web browsers to BrazilResources.com. At Yahoo Finance, ticker symbol BRI.V. Remember to ride the exciting gold stock run of 2016 and beyond. Your portfolio will thank you for adding shares of Brazil Resources.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.